It is March the 8th, and we are having a pre-Purim shiur. And so let's turn to the Megillah. 1252.
Oh, we're close to 1256.
Now, I took the liberty of listening to the, or at least listening to parts of the last time we had a pre-Purim shiur. And just to make sure that tonight we do something a little different. So, tonight, what we're going to discuss is the relationship between Purim and Pesach. Now, you would say that's kind of jumping the gun. I mean, is it Purim that we're talking about, or is it Pesach we're talking about? Let's deal with Purim. Let's worry about Pesach after Purim. Most women don't want to hear about Pesach until after Purim. My wife's grandmother is a Yeki. She's got half her house cleaned already for Pesach. You know, through the... Okay. Tell me, what does Purim have to do with Pesach? There is a very fundamental, there's actually a halacha, there's actually a law that has to do with Purim that's relevant to Pesach.
Because if Purim is over, you're supposed to start learning the halacha for Pesach.
Okay, why is that so? Okay, Purim is exactly 30 days right before Pesach. And the halacha is you're supposed to start talking about Pesach 30 days before you start Pesach. So that is the day of Purim. And therefore, at the Purim Seuda itself, at the meal on Purim, you're supposed to mention something about Pesach. That law, by the way, that you're supposed to talk about the Yontif 30 days beforehand, it's not just that you're supposed to talk about it. There's actually a practical application when it comes to a Rebbe and questions that he's answering. See, normally we say that if someone has a question on a topic, on the topic at hand, then they get answered first. So if a Rebbe is teaching a class on Parashas Vayeshev, and someone has a question about Parashas Vayeshev, someone else has a question about Parashas Devarim. So the Rebbe answers the one who asked about Parashas Vayeshev first, because he is Shoel Ke'inyin. He's asking on topic. The other one is asking off topic. So the one who's on topic gets precedence over the one who's off topic. But when you get to within 30 days of Pesach, any question regarding Pesach is considered on topic. Even if the Rebbe is teaching something else, a Pesach question is automatically on topic. So that means that Pesach is considered to be ke'inyan. It's considered to be asking on topic if you ask about Pesach on Purim. Mm-hmm. Here we're sitting on Purim, and we're dealing with Purim, and let's say there's a Rebbe who's giving a class on Purim, and he's talking about Purim. He's giving this class about Purim, and there's a whole bunch of people learning about Purim, and two people raise their hand, and he calls on the first one, he says, I have a question about Pesach. And so the Rebbe says, well, one second, what do you have to ask? He asks the other person, the person says, I have a question about Purim. So normally you would say, well, the one who's asking about Pesach is not on topic, so you answer the other person first. Here you wouldn't do that. The Pesach question is just as much on topic as the Purim question, because it's 30 days before Pesach.
So why was it connected? Why did they make such a halacha? Was it to extend the simcha of Purim?
Well, obviously they are connected.
Are they all Yom Tov?
Well, that is a discussion. That is a dispute, whether it's all Yom Tovim or just Pesach, because Pesach has so many laws. There are more laws about Pesach than about any other Yontif. So, ask any Rav, they will tell you that before Pesach is the most challenging time of year. That's when they get all the questions. It's much, much harder. So some say it's only Pesach, others say it's really all Yom Tov, not just Pesach. So, we see then that there is a relationship between Purim and Pesach. That on Purim itself, we're already, so to speak, holding in Pesach. How else do we see a very, very strong connection between Purim and Pesach? The other way around. How do we find that Pesach itself is really about Purim?
Didn't the story happen during Pesach?
Oh, the story of Purim takes place on Pesach. See, we celebrate Purim this time of year because starting tomorrow is when we had the war with our enemies. And we defeated them. And the next day, which this year is Monday, the 14th of Adar, Tuesday, which is the 14th of Adar, is the day that we rested, that we no longer had to fight. So we celebrate the day after the war. The war took place on the 13th of Adar, which is tomorrow, and they rested, as it says in the 9th chapter of Megillas Esther, they rested on the 14th of Adar, and that's when they made Purim. But that's when the war took place. The story that we read about is not that long of a story. It takes 10 chapters. But the vast majority of the 10 chapters, 8 of the 10, or actually I should say 7 of the 10, take place right around Pesach time. The 13th, 14th, 15th, and 16th of Nisan. The 13th of Nisan is 2 days before Pesach. The 14th of Nisan is the day before Pesach. The 15th and 16th of Nisan are the first 2 days of Pesach. The Purim story takes place on Pesach. I will show you right now in the verses where you see it, in Megillas Esther. But you know it also from the Haggadah. We actually mention Purim in the Haggadah itself. Where do we mention Purim in the Haggadah?
In the Vilel HaLaila.
Okay, in the end, in Nirtza, when we sing songs, and we have all the songs, not the Haggadah is the last one that we sing, that's the most famous. But all the other ones, Echad Miyodea, all the others that we sing, so one of the songs that we sing there is about, two of them actually, is about what happened on the night of Pesach. And there's a discussion about Purim, because Purim happened on Pesach. So Purim and Pesach are very, very closely connected. It's not just that they happen to follow each other, that Purim takes place and then the next holiday is Pesach. They actually are very strongly connected. Now let me show you the dates in the Megillah so that you see what I'm talking about. We know that the Megillah begins on 1252 with the party that Achashverosh has. And we know from the Gemara that the Jews should not have attended the party. And that was a mistake. We're going to discuss this evening, hopefully, why they should not have attended, and Mordechai told them not to attend, and why they attended anyway. What was is it that they just rejected Mordechai? Mordechai, who was the leader of the generation, they just said, "Oh, we're not listening to Mordechai today." Obviously, it's not like that. There must have been some reason why they didn't want to listen to Mordechai. So, hopefully, we'll cover that this evening. But that's how the story begins, with this party that the Jews attended that they should not have attended. And at the party, you know, of course, that Vashti was killed. Then you know that the king holds a beauty pageant and takes Esther as his queen. Then, starting with the second chapter, we have the meteoric rise of Haman to being viceroy. Third chapter. The second chapter, third chapter, is where you have on page 1254, where suddenly you have Haman rising to power. Now, it doesn't tell you the date that Haman rises to power, but he becomes second in command. And everybody bows down to Haman, except for
Mordechai.
Mordechai doesn't want to bow down to Haman. He doesn't bow. So Haman gets incensed, and he wants to destroy all of the Jewish people, not just Mordechai, but the entire Jewish people. Now, if you look in the third chapter, look on page 1255. Look on 1255. This is in the third chapter, in verse 7. B'chodesh harishon, pasuk zayin. B'chodesh harishon hu chodesh Nisan. In the first month, which is the month of Nisan, bishnas shteim esrei lamelech Achashverosh, which is the 12th year of the king Achashverosh. Now I want you to notice, the 12th year is fast forwarding from the beginning of the Megillah. The beginning of the Megillah was in the 3rd year, and now we're in the 12th year of Achashverosh. Yes? I'm sorry. We're on page 1255, and we're in Pasuk Zayin. The third parak, Pasuk Zayin, verse 7. This is when Haman becomes angry that Mordechai is not bowing down to him and resolves to kill all the Jews. So it says, B'chodesh harishon hu chodesh Nisan, in the first month, which is the month of Nisan, bishnas shteim esrei v'amelech Achashverosh, in the 12th year of Achashverosh's reign. And as I just mentioned, the Megillah in the first chapter, when it tells you about the party, it says it was in the 3rd year of Achashverosh's reign. So this is 9 years later. We have jumped from the first chapter to now, we've jumped 9 years. So this is...
From the party...
To here.
To 9 years.
Yeah, this is the 12th year.
Haman became...
Well, I don't know exactly what date he became king, mm-hmm. he became viceroy, but this is where he's going to say he wants to kill the Jews.
Yeah.
So it's in the 12th year of the king, in the first month of Nisan, he peel pur hu hagoro lifnei Haman, they cast lots in front of Haman, miyom liyom mechodesh lechodesh, shneim asa hu chodesh adar, from day to day, and from month to month, and it came out to the month of Adar. So it was in Nisan that he cast the lots. What Haman did is he took one lottery for the month, 1 through 12, and he picked number 12, which is Adar, and he also picked days of the month, 1 through 30, I guess, or 29, and he picked one. And that came out to the 13th of Adar, as we know, because that's when the war was, which was on the 13th of Adar. And I'll show you that again.
That wasn't a Friday, was it?
Was it a Friday? If you look further in this parak, further on, look in Pasuk Yud Gimel 13, Pasuk 13. V'nishloach sefarim biyad haratzim el kol medinos hamelech. I'm going to read it out of English. Letters were sent by courier to all the king's provinces, lahashmi laharog ulabedes kol haYehudim, to destroy, to slay, to exterminate all Jews, minarvad zaken, young and old, taf and hashem biyom echad, children and women in a single day, bishlosha asar lachodesh shteim asar huchodesh adar, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, ushalom lavoz, and to plunder their possessions. So the Jews were the decree was for the 13th day of the month of Adar. That's how it came out. But when did Haman draw the lots? He drew the lots in the month of Nisan. Now, if you think about it, that means that Hashem delayed this decree for almost as long as it could have possibly been. And Haman had to pick a lottery. And he's on the first day of Nisan. He's on the first month of the year, Nisan, when he's doing this lottery. Now, which day of that month did he do the lottery? Which day of Nisan did he draw the lots? So look, I'll show you what day of the month it was. If you look, one pasuk before that, pasuk Yud Beis, the 12, verse 12. This is after Haman sells the idea to Achashverosh. Vayikaru sofrei hamelech, and the scribes of the king were called, Bachodesh Harishon, in the first month, Bishlosha asar yom bo, on the 13th day of Nisan. And they wrote everything that Haman said to write. So, it was the 13th day of Nisan that the decree was signed into law that would be carried out 11 months later, on the 13th day of Adar. But it was on the 13th of Nisan where this decree is signed into law. Yes?
Does this mean that the Persians kept the lunar calendar, the same calendar that the Jews did?
That's a good...
Or is it just mentioned like this so that we understand?
That's a good question. The simple answer, the simple meaning is that the Megillah is reporting it how we would understand it. Right? However, we do know that Haman was aware of the Jewish months, because the Gemara says that when it came out in Adar, Haman was happy. If I were Haman, I would have looked at it as a bad omen. 11 months later, like it could have been any time, it could have been tomorrow. And instead it's 11 months from now. It sounds like God is delaying the whole thing. But Haman was happy. Why was he happy?
Because Moshe had died.
Because it was the month that Moshe died. Moshe died on the 7th of Adar. So Haman was happy that it was the month that the great Moshe died in. So, but he didn't realize that it's also the month that Moshe was born in. So he didn't realize that Adar really is a happy month for us as well. But at any rate, it's striking that it happened on the 13th of Nisan. Even though the decree is not till the 13th of Adar, 11 months later. Now the story here, even though we jumped 9 years from the first chapter to the third chapter, we're not going to move very fast now chronologically from here until the eighth chapter. From here in, it's going to move very slowly. It's going to be the 13th of Adar, the 14th of Nisan, 15th of Nisan, 16th of Nisan. Everything is going to take place just in these 4 days. The bulk of the story takes place over 4 days. The 13th of Nisan until the 16th of Nisan. Haman is hung on the 16th of Nisan, 4 days after his decree. 13, 14, 15, 16. He's hung only 4 days later. On the 16th of Nisan, he's hung. That's when he's hung. Which is why, and this is another connection between Purim and Pesach, I ask my children this every year, they're starting to catch on. But that's why some commentaries say that at lunchtime, at the Seudah of lunchtime, on the second day of Pesach, you're supposed to do something to symbolize the hanging of Haman. It's Pesach, it's not Purim. It's the second day of Pesach. But that's the day Haman was hung. So you're supposed to do something to remind everybody, this is the day that Haman was hung. There is such a custom.
What do you do?
What do I do?
I heard you should eat like smoked meat or something because of the gallows.
The first year I did it, I took a fork, and I took a little Lego man, you know, and I took something, some kind of candy the kids had. I twirled around. I twirled around the man, and I hung him from the fork, and I just showed the kids.
Whatever.
These days I usually just remind everybody. They all know already, you know, that it's the day that Haman was hung. But again, you see this connection, Purim and Pesach. I mean, that you're supposed to mention Purim on Pesach. Here we have you're supposed to mention Pesach on Purim, and now you're supposed to mention Purim on Pesach. So you see that they're really very closely related. So it happened on the 13th of Nisan that he makes his decree. Now, what happened after that? I don't want to go through the psukim. Well, I guess I can show you some of them. I'll show you how it happened. So on that day, the 13th of Nisan, when the riders were sent out, the couriers were sent out to send the messages, Mordechai then wears his sackcloth. And he, of course, starts to cry and wail and all that. And you know that Esther then wants to know what's going on. She doesn't understand why is Mordechai doing all this. So she sends to Mordechai, and Mordechai sends back to her what happened, that the Jews are in big trouble. And he tells Esther, you have to go before the king to plead our case. And she says that if I go before the king, he'll kill me. So Mordechai says, if you don't go, you'll be killed, everybody else will be saved. If you do go, then you'll be doing Hashem's will. And who knows, maybe this is why you became queen. So she agrees to go, but she says to Mordechai, I'll go if, what?
If you fast.
How many days?
3 days.
3 days. That you fast for 3 days. I want you and all the Jews in Shushan to fast for me for 3 days, so that I'll go before the king. And Mordechai agrees. Now, which days are those?
14th,
15th, and 16th of Nisan. This conversation between Esther and Mordechai was on the 13th of Nisan, which is the same day that Haman sent out the couriers. All that takes place on the 13th. He agrees to a 3-day fast, and he announces it, and on the 14th, 15th, and 16th, they fast. Now, if you look at the end of the 4th chapter, on the next page, 1256, the last verse in the fourth chapter, Pasuk Yud Zayin 17, it says, Vayavor Mordechai, Vayas Kechol Asher Tzibasa Olav Esther. And they translated it as Mordechai then left and did exactly as Esther had commanded him to enact this 3-day fast. However, our sages tell us, the Gemara says, this word Vayavor Mordechai, which means Mordechai then left, that's the literal translation. But the deeper meaning is, and Mordechai transgressed. Vayavor can mean the same thing as the word Aveira, to transgress. He did an Aveira. What do you mean he transgressed? So the Gemara explains he decreed a fast on Pesach. You're not allowed to fast on Pesach. Normally, a person's not allowed to fast on Pesach. You can't fast on a holiday. Not allowed to do that. And he decreed a fast on the 14th, 15th, and 16th of Nisan. Well, the 14th is okay, but the 15th and 16th are a holiday. You're not allowed to fast. So he transgressed. Now, it doesn't mean he did a sin. It means that he decreed that the Jews in this case, need to fast because it was a matter of life and death. And of course, for life and death, one is allowed to fast, even on a holiday. But it's trying to draw our attention to the fact that he decreed a fast day on a day where you're normally not supposed to fast, which was the 15th and 16th of Nisan. So here you have a three-day fast on the 14th, 15th, and 16th. Now, here's where it gets a little bit... There was a little bit of a dispute of how to understand the next few dates. I'm going to use Rashi's approach. Rashi is located here in the Megillah, but it's actually... There's other Rashis in the Gemara that I'm combining with the Rashis in the Megillah. And I'm putting those two together to formulate the following explanation. In the very next verse, the first verse in the fifth chapter, also 1256, it says, Vayihi bayom ha-shlishi, it was on the third day, Vatilbash Esther Malchus, Esther wore her royal clothing, Vatamod b'chatzar beis ha-melech ha-pnimis, and she stood in the inner courtyard of the king, Nochach beis ha-melech, facing the chamber of the king, Vamelech Yoshiv al kisei malchuso beis ha-melechus, and the king was sitting on his throne in his chamber, Nochach pesach habayis, facing the doorway of the chamber. And then, of course, Esther enters uninvited. She could have been killed. And you know the story how his scepter miraculously stretched out and touched Esther, so she would not be killed for having entered the king uninvited. So Esther enters the king's chambers on the third day. The third day from when? So some say the third day from the fast, but Rashi understands it differently. Rashi understands the third day from when the decree took place. In other words, when it says the third day, this was the 15th of Nisan. The first day is the 13th of Nisan when the decree was made. The second day is the 14th of Nisan, which is the first day of the fast. This is the third day, which is the 15th of Nisan, which is only the second day of the fast. That's when she entered. Now, she asked Mordechai to fast for 3 days. Once they agreed to fast for 3 days, she had the merit of their fasting. She didn't have to wait till the fast was over. And she went on the 15th of Nisan, the first day of Pesach, into the king. And the king says to her, what would you like? Esther, whatever you want, I'll do for you up to half my kingdom. And Esther says, if so, I want you and Haman to come today to a feast that I have made for you. Haman and the king come to Esther, and the king says again, what would you like, my dear queen, up to half the kingdom? And Esther says to him, if you really want to do something for me, you and Haman should come back tomorrow. That's the 16th of Nisan, the third day of the fast. That's what she says. That afternoon, Haman goes home, and he's on the top of the world. This is the first day of Pesach. It's just our time, right? First day of Pesach is a strong time for the Jewish people. And Haman is walking high. I mean, Haman is just, he's floating. He's got invited to a personal feast between himself and the king and queen. Just him and the king and queen, both today, and now he's got invited back tomorrow, and he's floating. And he walks past Mordechai, and everybody's bowing down, and Mordechai, nothing, doesn't bow. And Haman is seething. He's incensed. How dare that ingrate not bow to me? Haman goes home. He summons his wife, Zeresh, that evil woman, and all of his family. And he says, this ingrate Mordechai, what am I going to do? And they say, build a gallows 50 cubits high. A cubit is between a foot and a half and 2 feet. So we're talking 75 to 100 feet high. The higher it is, the idea is that way it can be seen further away. It's more of a display. And then go to the king and ask the king if you can hang Mordechai before tomorrow's feast with Esther. Then have Mordechai hung tomorrow during the day before the feast. And then you'll go to that second feast with Achashverosh and Esther, and you'll really be on top of the world, because then your final enemy is just he's hanging from the gallows while you're feasting with Achashverosh and Esther. So this is on the 15th of Nisan, first day of Pesach. That night, enter the 6th chapter, 1257, page 1257, chapter 6, verse 1, Balai lo hahu nadedashna samelch, and this is the turning point. This is where everything changes. This is the turning point. And many Balei Kriya, many Megillah readers, at this point, they read this verse with a little bit of a different tune to indicate that this is where this is the turning point. In the saga, this is where we've hit bottom, and now things are about to turn in our favor. That night, the king can't sleep. And as you know, he calls for his people to read from the Chronicles before him, and they get to the point about Mordechai, how he saved the king's life, and it had been recorded, and he was never rewarded. And you know the story, how he then commands, and then Haman comes, and Haman is asking to hang Mordechai, but before Haman can even get the words out of his mouth to ask the king to hang Mordechai, the king says to Haman, "What should I do with a person who I owe a big favor to?" And Haman thinks it's him. So Haman says, "All those, you know, ride him through the streets and have him wear the kingly, the royal vestments, and have him ride on the royal horse, etc., etc." And the king says, "Good idea. You take Mordechai, put him on the horse, and take him through the streets." Okay, and this is probably the most fun part of the story, right? So, and Haman has to take Mordechai through the streets, and all the accompanying degradation that causes him. Interestingly, you should know that the Gemara tells us that when Mordechai was getting up on the horse, this is the third day of the fast, Mordechai was very weak. He had been fasting for 3 days. And now he's got to get up on a horse. So when he had to get up on the horse, he couldn't get up. So Haman had to get down so Mordechai could step up on Haman to get up on the horse. That's what the Gemara says. So as Mordechai is getting up on the horse, he gives Haman a good zet, gives him a good kick as he's getting up on the horse. That's what the Gemara says he did. So he gets up on the horse, and Haman leads him through the streets, proclaiming, "Kacha yaseh lo isha shehamelech chafetz bikaro." So is what happens to the person that the king, of course the king here has a double meaning, it means Hashem, is interested in his honor. You know the story that Haman's daughter sees the procession. She assumes that it must be that it is Mordechai who is leading the horse and it is Haman who is on the horse. She just makes that assumption because anybody would have made that assumption before they saw what was going on. And therefore she prepares a reception for Mordechai. She takes the chamber pot, which is full, and takes it over to the window, and as they pass by, she dumps the chamber pot on the head of the person who is leading the horse, thinking it is Mordechai. The man looks up, it is her father. She is mortified. She jumps off the roof and kills herself. So that way Haman now comes back to his home. It says he comes back avel v'chafoi rosh. She comes back in mourning and smelling terribly. That is because his daughter has been killed and he has had a chamber pot spilled on his head. And it is at that moment that the guards come to take him to the feast. So now he comes back home. Not only is he wrecked, but he smells terrible in the whole thing. It's just like he's not ready for this at all. And he's schlepped to the second party, which is now on the 16th day of Nisan. It is there at the second party when finally Ahasuerus says to Esther, "What do you want?" And finally Esther reveals who she is. The king doesn't know it. And she says, she doesn't say it that way, she says, "A man is trying to kill me and my nation." He says, "Who is that?" And she points to Haman, and she says, "Haman harasha hazeh," this evil Haman. The king is incensed, because Charvona then informs the king about Haman's plot to hang Mordechai. That was the right thing at the right time, or in Haman's case, the wrong thing at the wrong time. That's why Charvona is remembered for good. Because Charvona, when the king was seething mad, he managed to, you know, someone can be very, very angry, but if he doesn't have an expression of that anger, the anger may just go away. But here, Charvona gave the king a way to take out his anger. So not only that, but Haman's got this gallows for Mordechai, who saved the king's life. And the king, in his anger, screams out, "Toluhu alav, hang him on that tree." And Haman is hung on the 16th day of Nisan.
Why does she wait a day? Why does she invite them back for the second day instead of having the conversation that first day?
That's a good question. I don't... Why does she have two parties? On the 15th of Nisan, she has the first one, then the second one.
More merit of the fast.
It could be the merit of the fast. See, the Gemara asks why she invited Haman to the party. Why don't you invite the king and tell the king at the party? Why invite Haman? The Gemara says one of the reasons why she invited Haman is so that the Jewish people shouldn't rely on their political connection. Because if the Jews knew that they had this great Esther who's very close to the king, they may not have davened so hard. So she invited Haman, the people would think that she was a turncoat. People thought that perhaps Esther has turned on them, that she's chumming up with Haman. So therefore, the Jews were really scared. Had they thought that we had a connection in the government, perhaps they wouldn't have davened so hard. So it could be that it has to do also why she delayed it. I don't know. That's a good question. Yeah.
This sudden change of heart in King Ahasuerus. He hated the Jews.
Yeah.
So why does he say, "Oh my God, you're going to be killed"?
Because this was the great plot of Mordechai, which outplotted Haman. By Esther never telling who she was, the king was enamored with Esther.
Haman said to there's
some
people.
Yeah. No, the king, the Gemara says that he hated the Jews more than Haman did. Right. But when Esther, at that moment, at the right time, mentions that she's a Jew, the king's world comes crashing down around him. Like, here's this wonderful queen of his, and all of a sudden, he's been a party to her extermination. Uh-huh. And the only way to get out of it is bump off Haman. It's his only way out. It's the only way to save face and get out of the whole thing. So that was the beauty of Mordechai telling Esther not to give away who she was. Okay, so that all takes place on Pesach. And then it takes another 11 months before there finally is a war. And the Jews win the war and we have the Purim story. The Purim holiday, I should say. But you see that the bulk of the Megillah takes place on Pesach. That's the bulk of the Megillah.
So when do we celebrate on Adar?
Because that's when the war was. We celebrate the fact that we won the war.
So we celebrate the fact
that the war was.
You couldn't take back the decree. Once the decree is made, I guess you couldn't.
Yeah, that's what the Megillah says. They could only order a second decree that would enable the Jews to fight back. But there was no way to rescind the first one.
Really? Is that why they're called
the Megillah says that. The Megillah says that Ahasuerus said to Esther after Haman is killed, and Esther comes before the king. So then, she says, you know, let's take away this decree. Ahasuerus says, I can't do that. But here's my signet ring. You do what you want. So they run another decree that the Jews should get together and they should fight back and defeat their enemies. Yeah.
What was it that Haman's wife said when she heard something like, "Oh, the Jewish people got you"? Something like that.
Yeah. I mean, this is a whole discussion in of itself, what she was telling Haman. But when Haman says that what happened with the carrying Mordechai through the streets, leading Mordechai through the streets, then she says, "Now you're finished. You see the Jews are moving up. You see that you're finished. There's no way you're going to beat them now, because you see that Mordechai now has the upper hand." Now, this connection between Purim and Pesach is so strong, the fact that we're supposed to mention Pesach on Purim, the fact that we're supposed to mention Purim on Pesach, and the fact that the whole Purim story happens on Pesach, it's not by chance that it all takes place on Pesach. So clearly, there is something that we have to understand about Purim that has to do with Pesach. Now, we know that Pesach is the holiday of redemption. And that's what we celebrate on Pesach, that we were redeemed, Tzuguzunt, from Egypt, the Exodus, on Pesach. That we know. We know that the Gemara tells us that Mashiach could come virtually any day. But there are times that it is more likely that he would come and times that are less likely that he would come. When is the most likely time of year for Mashiach to come? Nisan. The Gemara says, "Benisan nigalu," they were redeemed in Nisan. "Benisan asidim lihigalos," that in Nisan, in the future, we will also be redeemed. So, lihigal. So, Nisan is the month of redemption. It is the time that is the most likely for redemption to occur. That's Nisan. The story of Ahasuerus and Esther and Mordechai is the story that leads to a redemption. What redemption does it lead to?
To save from being destroyed.
Well, that's true, from Haman. But there's another redemption that it leads to.
The end of the
Gullus of Babel. They were in Gullus for 70 years from the destruction of the first Beis HaMikdash until the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. Those 70 years, this story takes place at the tail end of those 70 years. This heralds in that redemption. So the Purim story, which takes place on Pesach, is a story of redemption from exile. Just as Pesach commemorates a redemption from exile, the Egyptian exile, just as we say that the future redemption is most likely to take place around Nisan time, the story of Purim as well, which took place on Pesach, also is a redemption from exile, from the Babylonian exile, at the end of the 70 years. So how does that work? What does that mean? It's the end of the 70 years. Not only that, the whole story revolves around the redemption from this exile. Now, here we're going to get into some dates. I'm going to share with you some dates. Some of this you may know already. Some of it we've gone through before. Some of it we've gone through in our Wednesday night class for those who attend that. And we're going to put it all up on the board. I know that it's going to be a lot of math, and if you don't follow it, it won't be, you don't have to know every single date. The main thing is, follow the 70 years. That's the main idea over here. What are the 70 years, and what are we talking about? Okay. Now.
Is it 70 years from the destruction of the first temple to the...
To the construction of the second one, yeah. To the time they are redeemed. Okay. Nebuchadnezzar, the one who destroyed the first Beis HaMikdash. Nebuchadnezzar came to power. We're going to call it year one, because it's the first year of Nebuchadnezzar. We're going to call that year one. That's when Nebuchadnezzar comes to power. Okay? In his second year, he attacks and defeats Jerusalem. He does not destroy the Beis HaMikdash. He doesn't even take anybody into exile. He simply conquers Jerusalem. So the first year we're going to call that Nebuchadnezzar. And the second year we're going to call that Jerusalem, because that's when he defeats Jerusalem. Okay. 6 years later, in year 8, is the first exile. For those who do not attend the Wednesday night class, what that means is, he did not destroy the temple. What he did is, because of political issues that were going on, the Jews were rebelling, etc., we don't have to get into all of that, but he came back to Jerusalem and took the leadership of the people away. He exiled the king who was Yechoniah, and the leaders of the people. Who were the leaders of the people? Mordechai, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, Yechezkel. This is alluded to in the Megillah. If you look in the Megillah, take my recorder with me. If you look in the Megillah, in the second chapter, when Mordechai is introduced for the first time, back on page 1253, when Mordechai is introduced, you see the bold print verse. That's the one that we read out loud, because that's when Mordechai is introduced. Mm-hmm. After Mordechai is introduced, in the very next verse, in Pasuk Vav, verse 6, on page 1253, there it tells us a little bit about Mordechai. Who is this man Mordechai? Asher haglam Yerushalayim, that he was exiled from Jerusalem, im hagola asher haglasa, with the exile that had been exiled, im Yechaniah melech Yehuda, with Yechoniah, the king of Yehuda. That is a reference to this first exile. That is not a reference to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Asher haglan Nebuchadnezzar melech Babel. Then Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babel, took into exile. That is this first exile, when Mordechai and all the leadership of the Jews were dragged into Babylonia. But the Beis HaMikdash still stands, and another king is put in place, that is the king Tzidkiyahu. 11 years later, again because of upheaval, Nebuchadnezzar returns, and he destroys the temple. Destroys the Beis HaMikdash. That is in the year 19. Yes?
Who is the king
Tzidkiyahu? What's that?
Who is the king
at Tzidkiyahu? Yeah, Tzidkiyahu. That's right. Yeah.
So when we were taken out to Babylonia,
mm-hmm.
Who was at the temple? Who was? It was totally empty?
No. The leadership was taken in year 8.
Yeah.
The people were still there.
So we kept doing...
Yeah. Everything went on for another 11 years until year 19. That's when it was finally destroyed.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Nebuchadnezzar lives. He remains king for 45 years. At the end of 45 years, he dies. And he is succeeded by his son, whose name is Evil-Merodach, which in English would be spelled evil, but Evil-Merodach. Evil-Merodach. Okay? 45 years. That's how long Nebuchadnezzar's reign lasted. Evil-Merodach, now here you have a little bit of a problem. Evil-Merodach ruled for 23 years. For 23 years, which means we should put the number 68 over here. Mm-hmm. And that is what all the kings thought. The thing is, though, that really Nebuchadnezzar ruled for 44 and a half years, and Evil-Merodach ruled for 22 and a half years. So it was really only a total of 67 years. This is a problem, as we're going to see in a moment. But in the years, we'll count it now as year 67, he dies, and I'm going to put in parentheses 68, because that's the way the secular world counted it. They counted it as 68. But in year number 67, he dies. He is succeeded by Belshazzar. What is Belshazzar famous for?
The writing on the wall.
He's famous for the writing on the wall. Belshazzar, in his third year, throws a party. Remember that? Remember? Mm-hmm. Ahasuerus throws a party. Mm-hmm. Well, Belshazzar, in his third year, throws a party. Ahasuerus in his third year throws a party. We're not talking about Ahasuerus yet.
Mm-hmm.
But Belshazzar in his third year throws a party. The writing on the wall, Daniel interprets it, that everything is finished for Babel. That night Belshazzar is assassinated, and the army of Babel is defeated, and Babel, Babylonia, loses its supremacy in the world. So in year 70, Belshazzar is killed, and now comes, they thought it was 71, but it was actually Belshazzar is killed, and he is succeeded by the Medes and the Persians. So he is succeeded by Dariavish, or Darius. The English is Darius. Dariavish, who is no longer Persian. He is a Mede. I don't know how to spell Mede in English.
M-E-D.
What is it?
M-E-A-D.
No, M-E-D.
M-E-D.
What is it? M-E-D-E-S. Okay. He is a Mede.
Yes.
Right, he is a Mede. Okay, that's what I thought. So he's a Mede, Dariavish, no longer Babylonia, but he succeeds him. He lasts 1 year, and he is succeeded by Koresh. Now, here again, we have a year between Koresh and Dariavish. See, Dariavish rules for 1 year. He rules for 1 year, and Koresh rules for 3. But again, let me say that again. Between Dariavish and Koresh, the secular dating was 5 years between the two of them. But it was that one of them was for 1.5 years, and the other one for 2.5 years, for a total of 4. They counted it as 1.5, they counted it as 2 and 3, it's actually 1.5 and 2.5, and a total of 4. So we would say that it was the next year that Koresh took over, and they would count that as year 73. Okay. Koresh did something spectacular. Koresh, in his first year, did something spectacular. Koresh authorized the rebuilding of the temple. He authorized the rebuilding of the temple. He told the Jews, go back and rebuild the temple. That's what he said. He authorized the rebuilding of the temple.
This is Cyrus, right?
Yeah. That's right. So he said, rebuild the temple. And they started to rebuild it. He lasted 3 years, which is year 74. That's when how long he lasted. And he was succeeded by our good buddy, Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus. You know what he did? He stopped it. He said, stop rebuilding. Or stopped, I should say. Okay. He stopped it. So the Jews laid the foundation for the second temple in the first year of Koresh. They began to lay the foundation of the second temple, which was then halted by Ahasuerus when he became king. Ahasuerus rules for 14 years. The Purim story takes place in his 12th and 13th years, meaning the lot of Haman, this whole thing happens in his 12th year, the actual battle happens the next year in his 13th year, and he rules for 14 years, and he is succeeded by his and Esther's son. I'm such as 88, sorry. He's an Esther's son. Right? Who is, well, he has different names, but he's primarily known as Dayavish the Second. Right. Okay. And he authorizes the rebuilding of the temple, and it actually happens in his day. The temple's rebuilt.
Does he know he's Jewish?
I don't know.
He was a Jew.
What?
Yes, he was a Jew.
He's Esther's son.
Now, he was raised in the temple. He was raised in the palace of Ahasuerus. Esther did not have much power in raising him as a Jew. But he is raised, and he's the one who actually authorizes it, and the temple is actually rebuilt in his day. Now, what's with these parties? The party of Ahasuerus and the party of Belshazzar, they all knew that the Babylonian exile was to take 70 years. Everybody knew it. The Jews knew it. The non-Jews knew it. And everybody was counting the 70 years. Everybody was a little bit nervous that when these 70 years are over, God is going to redeem the Jews. And when God redeems the Jews, then we're all finished. So everybody, even though the temple was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar, he wasn't worried about it because he died and he knew he was going to die before the 70 years were over. Eben Merudah almost made it to 70 years, but he
didn't have to deal with it either.
Belshazzar becomes king and he thinks, you know, would you count the 70 years from? You count the 70 years from the time that Nebuchadnezzar became king. That's when you should count the 70 years from. Therefore, in his third year, now remember, they think it's 68 years. It was actually 67 years. They thought it was 68 years. In his third year, which is the 71st year, he says, it's been 70 years. No redemption. Obviously, God used to love the Jews. Yes, he used to choose the Jews, but he has given up on them. No more Jewish people. No more chosen people. God's not after them anymore. It's all over. And he made a party. At this party, he took out the captured utensils from the temple and used them. Wore the garments of the Kohen Gadol and abused that as well. He said, obviously, there's no more temple. Until then, they were all afraid to do it, because who knows what the consequences would be. It's one thing to destroy the temple, but it's another thing then to go and use those utensils for themselves. They were very afraid of doing that. And so, he uses them, at that party, when he used the utensils, that's when the handwriting goes on the wall, and he is assassinated that night. Yes?
Did you see the Balshazzar happen from when the Buchanan
Yeah.
But it wasn't his party, it was Al-Hashir's party.
No, not Al-Hashir's party.
This is
Balshazzar. Balshazzar is the first one to make
it.
They both did. Balshazzar did it first. Al-Hashir did it.
Same night.
Yeah.
What was their source that the year the Jews would be redeemed?
There were two prophecies about it. One in Daniel, and the other one, I don't remember. But there were two prophecies about it. And this is where, they all knew it. Now, that was Balshazzar's mistake, and he was killed. He's succeeded by Dariavash and by Koresh. Achashverosh becomes king. Yes?
He kills him.
Who? Balshazzar?
Yeah.
It said in the verses, I don't remember. It says it was this. So then Achashverosh becomes king. Now Achashverosh says, Balshazzar, he knew what he was talking about. He didn't know how to count. I know how to count. But you know what Balshazzar's mistake was? He was counting from the first year of Nebuchadnezzar. Yeah, that was a mistake. You don't count a Jewish exile from when Nebuchadnezzar became king. You count from when the Jews went into exile. Well, when is that? Says Achashverosh. The real intelligent Achashverosh. He says, you know what that was? That was from the first exile. Now, he's also making a mistake. He says, you count the 7 years from the first exile. That's when you count from. So he says, okay, well, let's figure it out. The first exile happened here. Now, Achashverosh becomes king. We know it was year 74. He thinks it's year 77. That's what he thinks. And so, I made a mistake here. That should be 70. What's that? No, not 78. 1 second. That should be 76. Sorry. He thinks it's year 76. Okay. So, did I do that right? Yeah. He thinks it's year 76. Okay. He says, well, really, you're supposed to count from the first exile. Not from here, but from here. So he says, okay, it's now year 76. You got to count 70 years from year 8. So he waits 2 more years to year 78. That's the second year of his reign. The second year finishes, nothing happened. Third year of his reign, which he thinks is year 79, which is now past 70 years from the first exile, no Jews, no God, no redemption. The Jews are finished. Time for a party. And he also does the same thing. If you look in the first chapter, you know the, how the reader reads this verse. The very beginning of the Megillah, 1252, he makes this big party, and at the party, he takes out the utensils of the Beis HaMikdash. Verse 7, V'hashkos b'chlei zahav, the drink was served in golden utensils, v'chelim mikelim shonim, which is translated as right, different types of goblets. But you know that the reader reads that in the tune of Eich of Lamentations. Mm-hmm. And the reason why it's read that way is because that's a reference to the utensils of the temple. That he also took out the utensils and used them. He also miscounted. Not only did he miscount because they got the years wrong, but he miscounted because he was counting from the first exile, when instead he should have been counting from the destruction of the temple itself. That night, that day, that Achashverosh miscounted, the Gemara says, Vashti is killed. Vashti, who is a descendant of who? Nebuchadnezzar. Vashti was of royal blood.
And when did you say she was killed?
She was killed at that party. At Achashverosh's party, she's killed. I believe is a granddaughter. She was a descendant of Achashverosh, of Nebuchadnezzar. Achashverosh was not of royal blood. He wanted to become king, so he married Vashti in order to give himself some credibility. But Vashti was a descendant of the man who destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. She is killed at the party when the utensils are misused. So she's killed as well. But Achashverosh was also wrong. The 7 years actually should have been counted from the time the temple was destroyed. If you count through from when the temple was actually destroyed, Dariavish becomes king in year 88, which is 69 years after the destruction of the temple. And 2 years later, you have to go 70 and then 70, it's always the 71st year. 2 years later, which is year 90, is actually when the temple is rebuilt. Or it's, you know, that's when they start to actually build it up. That's the chronology of what happened.
But I want to show you, I know that we're at the end of time, at the time of regret, right? The end of time.
But you have to see this. This is what's really striking about the whole thing. What's really striking about the whole thing is, I talked to you about this in the Wednesday night class a couple of times, how the destruction, you see it from here, happened in stages. It happened in stages. First, Jerusalem was conquered, then the first exile, then the temple was destroyed, then actually other things also that lead up to it. The rebuilding of the temple also happens in stages, where first Babel, Babylonia, is destroyed, then you have the authorization of the rebuilding, and then finally it's rebuilt. It's more than that. The 70 years have dual meanings. It's true that the rebuilding of the temple will only take place 70 years after the destruction of the temple. But there are other significant events that happen 70 years from each of these points as well. 70 years from when Nebuchadnezzar becomes king is when Belshazzar is killed. This is 70 years apart from here to here. From here to here. Right? 7 years from when Jerusalem is first conquered. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm doing it a little wrong. 7 years from when Nebuchadnezzar becomes king is when the authorization of the temple happens. In year 71, after Nebuchadnezzar becomes king, then 70 years later, it is authorized to be rebuilt. That actually happens. Then, 70 years after after the temple is actually destroyed, is when the temple is rebuilt. So the Purim story, with this party going on, is all about redemption. That's what it's all about. The whole crux of the matter is, will the Jews be redeemed or won't they be redeemed? That is what the discussion is all about in the Purim story and all the events leading up to the Purim story. And this is the important thing to understand. Achashverosh makes this party and he invites the Jews. He wants the Jews at this party. He serves them kosher food. He brings in a kosher caterer and makes sure everything is kosher. 100% glatt kosher. He gets kosher wine. Everything is for the Jews perfectly. There should be no reason for the Jews not to attend. Mordechai warns the people, don't go to the party. Why? Says Mordechai, because this party is all about us. The reason for the party is because Achashverosh is celebrating that we have been forsaken by God. That's the purpose of the party. And therefore he says, you can't go to this party. Jews can't go to a party that is celebrating the demise of the Jews. You can't go to such a party. And the Jews said back to Mordechai, how can we not go? If we don't go, the king will become incensed. And then he'll kill us. We have to go. So you'll say, yeah, but it's celebrating our demise. We know it's not true. We know that God is eventually going to redeem us. So good, they're making a mistake. Let them make a mistake. Who cares? So they're making a mistake. Why can't we go to the party? We have to go, because otherwise we're under the control of the king who can just kill us out in a second. So how can we get him angry? Mordechai says, don't go. And they say, I'm sorry, Mordechai, we have to go. It's politically the astute thing to do. Otherwise, we'll be killed. They go to the party, and now they have a threat that they'll be killed. Because they went to the party, now comes the decree that they're going to be killed. That's what the Gemara tells us. Because they went to the party, that's why Hashem allowed Haman to rise in power and to be ready to destroy the Jewish people. Then, when Esther goes before the king, and when Esther says, Mordechai, I will go only if all the Jews fast. So Mordechai goes to the people and says, we have to fast for 3 days. And the people could have said, you know, let's try some political maneuvering, let's try this, let's try that. But the Jews listened to Mordechai. He said fast, they fasted. He said 3 days, they fasted 3 days. He said fast on Pesach, on the first 2 days of Pesach. They didn't say, Mordechai, you know, says over here you're not supposed to fast. It says in the Torah you're not supposed to fast. They didn't question him. They said, Mordechai, you said it? Aye, aye, sir. You say jump, we'll say how high. They demonstrated that they were willing to listen to Mordechai, where originally they were not willing to listen to him. And when they were willing to listen to Mordechai, then Hashem turned the whole thing around. And then they were redeemed, Haman was destroyed, and the decree was rescinded. And that then brought in the redemption. So the connection between Purim and Pesach is that Purim and Pesach are really cut from the same cloth. Purim is what heralds in redemption. Purim is the stage that brings about the redemption. Redemption can only happen once we Jews are willing to make ourselves subservient to Hashem. As long as we're saying to the Mordechais of our people, you know, Mordechai, we think you're a great person and all that, but, you know, you're missing the boat over here. We can't listen to you. When we act that way, then we're not worthy of redemption. Once we're willing to say to our Mordechais, aye, aye, sir, we'll listen to what you have to say, that's when we are worthy of redemption. Purim heralds in Pesach. And the whole story of Purim is revolving around this question of redemption. That's why Purim and Pesach are so inextricably tied together. That's why on Purim you mention Pesach, that's on Pesach you mention Purim, that's why the story takes place on Pesach, and that's the whole connection between the two. There are other factors that connect them, but we're already 7 minutes over time. But this is the thing, to go into Purim with the understanding of Pesach. Then there's a question. Yes?
Did you then realize that Mordechai had been right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then we're doing Teshuvah.
All right, I have three questions. Number one, why did Ahasuerus hate the Jews? That he, you know, what was his anger?
He was not a descendant of Amalek.
No, he was an anti-Semite. I mean, I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know what his vendetta was.
Okay, now Mordechai, Esther told Mordechai to tell the people to fast. But there was no message from Hashem to Mordechai.
Right. Right. Mordechai understood that this was the what to do in order to save the people.
Okay, so it was
his judgment, right. Right.
If you take the Holocaust, that's very...
You know, from the Pharaoh to Nebuchadnezzar to all of them, somehow they have a fear of the Jewish God.
Right, right.
Yeah. And how do they know so much about the Jewish God, and why did they fear?
Our enemies of the past understood that our God was powerful. They just didn't want to believe that we were actually connected to Him.
Can you show me the second
time? Dina's next. Just before we go on, I just want to make sure, next week, the 15th of March, I almost said Nissan. The 15th of March, we're going to have class at 8 o'clock, not at 7:30. It'll be 8 o'clock. But I have something else I have to be at. There's a thing for the kids. The following week, the 22nd, is the Amram Institute. So we will not have class that night on the 22nd. Okay, so the 15th will be 8 o'clock. The 22nd, we will not meet. The 29th, we'll have one more class before Pesach. That'll be our last class before Pesach.
The day that Ahasuerus had his party and the Jews went with Yom Kippur.
I remember something like that. I don't have to look it up again. But yeah, I remember something like that. Yeah.
The Jews haven't learned anything yet.
I don't know anymore. Hopefully we're learning.
Soviet Union existed 70 years.
What's that?
Soviet Union existed 70
years. 70 years. That's a good question.
I think that was right.
You're counting from 1917?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Was the second 70 years on that list there?
The first 70 years.
No, the first one was from the conversion to Darius, right?
From Nebuchadnezzar right, that's right. The other one is from Temple Destroyed, 19, until 90.
90,
right.
Did you speak about the exchange of money between...
I didn't discuss it.
Oh.
I didn't talk about it. Yeah, there's a lot to talk about over there. Yeah.
There's a thing about the Kalachah.
Tefillah. Kalachah. Tefillah. Yeah.
Something like, it's just come out recently. We haven't heard this 20 years.
Yeah.
Maybe just, I haven't heard it.
I've only heard it recently.
Yeah, so why?
It doesn't mean it's not true.
No, that's saying it's not true, but how come we're just hearing this? I just said to my husband, we're just hearing this now.
I don't know, people have gotten into it recently. I don't know. You know, it makes sense. It makes sense. It makes sense. I mean, they davened, you know.
Right.
They didn't daven on Purim. That's the funny
true,
thing.
Wasn't
there was a Pesach.
Right. Okay, but that was the year before.
But this thing? Right.
Uh-huh. No, so, okay.
So.
4 years.
Okay.
I had a similar question that somebody else asked.
Would it not have said
was, in terms of the relationship between the nations and us.
Oh, we'll have to look at the
same. And, what was the question? Oh, yeah. So, why did they care that, you know, we were going to come back and, you know, Hashem was going to be with us? So what? What do we do when we come back?
Well, their power, they represented the power of the whole world. They were in charge of the whole Middle East. They were in charge of these kingdoms represented the rejection of the Jewish people. That's what they were all about. It was all about who's got the control over the whole world.
So they were afraid of us coming into what? We never ruled. We never.
Right. No, it wasn't. It wasn't a question. It was anti-Semitism. I mean, the Gemara says anti-Semite is the same as anti-God. So that, you know,
so God, and the Jews have the wisdom that God rules.
Right,
so.
When we're sovereign, then what we're saying is that Hashem is in charge. They don't want to hear that.